It is just about 23 minutes after the hour. It's a Tuesday morning. Don Clark joins us from Garden Valley, Texas. Dr. Don is a biochemist, a member of the Board of Creation Moments, and a vintner of note, I should say. What note is that, Don?
No, that's a good question.
Okay, well.
Let's see, fine wines of East Texas, I suppose.
Okay, yeah.
Be a G sharp, I think.
A taste of Tuscany from the heart of Texas, as I recall.
That works, too.
So, fine wines and a good bit of scientific knowledge. Don spent a good many years in the pharmaceutical industry, and we've had some marvelous discussions on COVID and vaccines and the like, but we're kind of going up in altitude with our discussion today. There's an opinion piece. This is the first time we've really worked with an opinion piece, an editorial from The Federalist. It's written by Stephen C. Meyer, who was also the author of a book, and he works with the Discovery Institute Center for Science and Culture in Seattle. And his point is that there have been three major scientific discoveries in the past century that point to God. And it seems to be kind of setting evolutionists back on their heels just a bit. And Don, I'd like to start with a question. This is a magnificent way to this term is just, what is a Goldilocks universe?
Oh, well, you're starting from point two.
Yeah.
You know, you skipped over point one.
Well, we don't have to take them in
anyway,
order.
Anyway, Goldilocks, the term refers to, that was coined back in the 60s because it was discovered by cosmologists, by physicists, that, oh my goodness, the universe is so finely tuned, for life that I don't know how this could have just come about by happenstance, you know, by circumstance. I mean, it just, by randomness, it just, every aspect of the universe seems to be tuned so that, it can support life. Sir Fred Hoyle, for example, argued a common sense interpretation of the data suggests that a superintelligent has monkeyed with the physics to make life possible.
Interesting way to put it.
Yeah. So how do we get, for example, the parameters of such things as the gravitational pull and attraction and every aspect of the atom is such that if you perturb like the strong forces or the weak forces even within the atom, then it makes life impossible. So how do you go from that, and of course, you know, the gravitational fields and everything, if the gravitational pull was a little bit greater and things were more compact, then life wouldn't have evolved, or if it was a little bit looser, then, you know, things would have been spread apart, and again, you know, life wouldn't be supported. So all of these types of things, you know, help to support life. And even, you know, for example, even on Earth, the tilt of the Earth is such that, you know, if it's not where it is, we wouldn't have the seasons that we have. We wouldn't have the tides with the position of the moon, for example. We wouldn't have the tides that we have. That all of this, you know, supports not only sea life, but of course life on land as well.
Is this just a custom-made Earth or a custom-made universe? Now, he's talking about the universe here. Does science know enough to safely say that there are commonalities between what we've discovered on Earth and on far-flung galaxies and other planets, that somehow the basic chemistry is the same? Do we know that?
Yes. So, you know, you mentioned, well, okay, maybe just Earth is fine-tuned. Well, as I just mentioned, the moon is in the right place. in order to support life on Earth. And of course, the sun is in the right place, and we're just at the right place away from the sun so that we're not too hot. You get closer, you get a little bit hotter, or you get a little bit further away, you get a little bit colder. That's just our solar system, but our galaxy is just right, and the galaxies in the universes are just right. So it all tied together as if, someone really thought about this before it was all put together. Now, the evolutionist and the atheist would point out and say, well, we can get a fine-tuned universe. All we need to do is hypothesize a multiverse. And we just create billions upon billions of universes, and certainly one of those is going to be fine-tuned for life. But in order to get, a fine-tuned universe, you have to have a universe that's almost fine-tuned, before that. And then before that, you need one that's almost fine-tuned. And so you go back to this, it's like a circular argument. You go back and say that, ultimately, in order to get a fine-tuned universe, something has to be fine-tuned from the very beginning. And their argument of we can solve this problem by a multiverse is just a circular argument. And the only way you can get a fine-tuned universe is to create it that way from the beginning. No evolution or universe evolution, in this case, here with our universe. And like I said, it's not just Earth, it's the whole universe. The amount of matter that's there, the stuff that we see, everything out there, it helps to support life, and in particular life here on Earth. It's hard to imagine, really. I mean, how could, a galaxy billions, or at least, millions and millions of light years away, affect life here on Earth? But it does. It's all tied together.
Okay, well, you should be aware that my job here as the moderator, as the host, is to do what I can to throw a monkey wrench into your theories and suppositions here.
Oh, okay.
What if God created, Genesis says he made the universe first and then he made us. So he made the universe any which way he wanted to. He saw what it was like, and then he made us so we would work in it, that we would fit. We would be the piece of the puzzle. So we were created to match the universe, not the other way around.
Wouldn't it be interesting if this was not the first try? That maybe back in ancient history, he tried a couple of other times.
There would be a divine oops.
Oops. Oh, man. This didn't work. Oh, man. Okay, yeah. Too much sun. Okay, too much moon. All right, let's fine-tune this. All right. Okay, let's go back.
Well. Actually, Jim, you're off a little bit, because the first thing, the first thing that God created was light. And he separated the light from the darkness, and we went through that series, some time back. But he did create the earth. He created the earth, which was, mostly water. Then he had to have the dry land appear. And then on the dry land, of course, he made plants. And he made this before the sun and the moon were put into place, and the stars and the galaxies and all this other stuff. So we already had plants on the earth. So the creation order really is that, there was earth as a spherical ball of water. And then he separated the waters from, above, the heavens, and from below the heavens, and so the suggestion is that there's a whole bunch of water out there at the ends of the universe, if you will. But be that as it may, Earth was formed, and then the planets were formed. planets were formed on the Earth before the stars and the moon.
So that indicates a priority, a pre-planned order of creation.
Yes. And so if we, you know, if we go back to that order, we find evidence, for example, that other planets have water deep below their surface that haven't, you know, escaped, for example, into the thin atmosphere that they might have. And indeed, it does look like even the planets, you know, that are in our solar system, were first balls of water, and out of the balls of water, you know, of course, land appeared with those as well. So however God, you know, created it, and why he created it that way, is an interesting thing. For example, we talked about, I think at one point in time, that the magnetic field around the Earth couldn't have existed just from an iron core, for example, just, you know, spinning on the inside, that it had to have a much greater momentum. And if you actually go through, and I couldn't do it myself, but other creation scientists have done this, go through, and it requires that the Earth first start off to be made of water, and the planets as well. So the creation order, you know, helps to describe.
You know what's amazing to me is that you can take two weightless, odorless, invisible gases, put them together, and you get water. I mean, that's astounding all by itself.
It is astounding. Of course, when you do that, you know, you've got to get a little bit of energy out of that. And of course, when we take hydrogen and oxygen and split the water into we have for example
electrolysis, yeah,
hydrogen car, if you will. Mm-hmm. Which the battery that is run in those vehicles depends on recombining hydrogen and oxygen to produce water. So they're the only thing that comes out of their tailpipe, if you will, mm-hmm. is actually water. You have to put in hydrogen and oxygen, obviously, in order to do that. And that, you know, they were trying to develop that, but other alternatives are coming along. So anyway, be that as it may, one of the things that we've discovered here in the last century or so is that, gee, our universe is finely tuned. Well, another aspect, of course, is the great discovery in 1953 by Watson and Crick, they finally came up with the structure of the DNA based on radiation work. You know, we had the scientist over here that was also studying that same aspect, but they came up with it first. They discovered that, the DNA is a lattice. It's like a ladder that is a twisted ladder. And the rungs of the ladder, for example, are made up of base pairs or chemicals that attract one another, that holds this ladder together via hydrogen bonding. And but the most important thing that they discovered was that, in this ladder, in the rungs of the ladder, is a code. And the base pair code then codes for our genes. It's the genetic code. And so they discovered that, wow, you know, the DNA contains information. And it's so much information is packed into the DNA that, Richard Dawkins himself, who is an evolutionist and an atheist, has acknowledged that the machine of code of the genes is uncannily computer-like. That is, he was comparing the genes in the DNA to the coding in the DNA to computer code. Now, any reasonable person would, you know, if you see a computer and you see a computer working, you would, the first, you know, maybe not the first thought, but, you know, you would say, gee, this was intelligently designed. Somebody, or a lot of people, as the today's computers, for example, you've got distributing code making, if you will. Not one person writes the whole code for different types of programs and the operating systems and that. But just to run a computer and to have word processing and, you know, spreadsheets and even what we're doing today, which is having a video chat over Skype, for example, requires a tremendous amount of code. And that code obviously was written by a group of people who had a purpose in mind and a function in mind, and you had to put that function into computer language in order for your computer to be able to do what it's doing, you know, right now. Even Bill Gates, of course, Bill Gates is not known for his religious beliefs, but even Bill Gates said the DNA is like a computer program, but far, far more advanced than any software we've ever created. And so you ask yourself, at least I ask myself, how can somebody like this, who recognizes that the biology, that the central piece in a living cell, the DNA, is so far more advanced than anything man could create on his own, and recognize that, okay, if it takes me all of this energy and time and money to create this computer code, why don't they take the next step and say, oh my gosh, there is an intelligent designer, and you know, these folks that actually believe in God, perhaps they are absolutely right that there is a God, and the evidence for him is all around us, and to disregard that is not being, you know, is being disingenuous, because there's so much evidence. And the more we look within biology, the more we see that every aspect of life is programmed, is designed eloquently. You know, things in biology just don't happen, by chance. That the internal structure of the cell itself, I mean, it's not just protoplasm and just a bunch of chemicals randomly bumping into each other, but there is scaffolding involved, and there is issuing or transporting things in and out of the cells, within the cells, going to specific locations. You know, there is an energy generator, a battery, if you will, inside our cells called mitochondria, that produces a molecule that runs everything within the cell. And without one piece of, if you're lacking one of the essential pieces within the cell, the whole cell falls apart. So it's all, not only is the genetic code, for example, very, very important, but you can't even use the genetic code without all of the other pieces within the cell. So if one of those pieces or one of those things falls apart, then you've got a problem, and you don't have a cell anymore. So they all work together, and this working together is a hierarchy, if you will, of intelligent design. Starting with all of the information, all of the books and books of information that is in the DNA, and then reading that information with all of the rest of the mechanism of the cell.
There is both rhyme and reason to everything in this chain of creation. One link dependent upon everything that came before and everything that came after. It really does shout design. One of the stories that's been making news here over the past week or so is somebody's, I can't pin it down to the people, they say, we can have a Jurassic Park now. We can create dinosaurs. We can recreate the environment of in this case, you know, their assumption 60 to 65 million years ago. We could do that. What a interesting thing that would be. But still, they can't do it from scratch. They have to start with DNA.
They have to start with the DNA. If you don't have the genetic code, for example, of a dinosaur, or let's say a Triceratops, if you can't get that information, then guess what? You're not going to make a Triceratops. But it takes more than the DNA code, because you've got to put the DNA code in a biological machine called a cell, and in particular a biological machine that was designed specifically for that genetic code. So, you know, that's why in Jurassic Park, the old movie now, I mean, you know, it called Jurassic Park, I guess it came out in the 60s. I don't
know. It was more recent than recall. That, I think, the 80s maybe.
But anyway, it was, they took the genetic code from the amber from a mosquito bite of a dinosaur, and they isolated the DNA, and then they put it into frogs, for example, in frog cells to be able to they required the cell, for example, in order to make the proteins and ultimately make the Triceratops whatever they were happening to make. But even that is very, very simplistic, because you can't take a frog cell make a Triceratops with it, because it's not going to have all the pieces that the Triceratops needs for its cells, for example, in order to make a complete Triceratops.
And so, you still need to create an environment in which they can survive. So you need to be aware of that, too. And there may have been a different chemistry involved 65 million years ago. I don't know. I want to mention to listeners that one of our listeners in the chat window at BrokenRoadRadio.com has put a link to a YouTube video which reveals in animation, I think I've seen this, the inner workings of a cell. And he described it as absolutely breathtaking, and it is, if it's the same one I'm thinking of. But you can click on that in the chat window at BrokenRoadRadio.com and take a look at that video. But
want to get your mind blown about how things are moving in this world of ours?
Yeah,
Jurassic Park was released in
1993.
93. 93. Holy smokes.
Wow, and it seems like it was a long time ago.
It seemed like ancient history.
Oh, my goodness, man.
It was. Yeah, the book was written in 1990.
It was a generation ago, 28 years ago.
Oh,
my goodness.
Man.
Mm-hmm.
And while we were talking about us playing with our DNA and our system and not really totally understanding all the things that are going on, I'm thinking about the Wuhan flu shots that are being passed around now, and the Johnson & Johnson, I guess you can call them trials. They've been stopped in certain areas because they seem to be bringing on blood clots, and we have no idea what they're bringing on, because they're not normal vaccinations.
There's something
weird in there, and we don't know what's going
to
happen.
Well, it boils down to DNA, in this case, RNA. Now, this is kind of a change of subject, but we've talked about that here. It's not a true vaccine, is it, Don?
Not in the vaccine sense. Normally, a normal vaccine, for example, is made. You take the organism that is causing the problem, whether it be a virus or bacteria. In this case, it's a virus, obviously. You denature it, or you partially denature it, so it can't actively infect a cell. And then you take, the pieces, the proteins and stuff that make up the virus and the virus coat. You inject that in people, and people develop antibodies against the pieces of the non-active virus, and they build up immunity to that virus. Not so with these new experimental. These have not been improved. You know, folks think that they've been approved by the FDA. They have not been approved by the FDA.
Nope.
They've been approved to do massive clinical trials. That's what's going on right now. These vaccines are really gene therapy. They're messenger RNA that's being injected. The messenger RNA must get into your cell. Your cell then uses its protein synthesis abilities, and the messenger RNA must go to the ribosomes and the mechanism that makes your proteins. It makes the spike protein, for example, and then the cell must break apart and release the spike protein into your bloodstream, where your immune system then sees, oh, I got a foreign protein. I better do something about it. And then the process of making antibodies to that spike protein, the normal immune response then takes over. But this is a far different than any vaccines we've ever created before. Never been done in humans. The animal studies were disastrous. It would never get approved normally. And here we are injecting millions of people with these things and not really understanding what the immediate side effects are, much less the long-term side effects of such technology. Does this messenger RNA just stay in your cells for a period of time? Does it get in, some people have suggested that it would get incorporated into the DNA, but we have another membrane or a nucleus where the DNA is located, and I'm not aware of transport into the DNA from the outside from the cytoplasm of the cell, for example. But is there a reverse transport mechanism within the cell that we don't know about? And it ultimately, now you're making cells that carry the messenger RNA in the genetic code, which then, would be obviously in the DNA. And now your cells are continually making this spike protein. What long-term effects would that have, for example?
What I'm hearing is this vaccine is not organic, it's plastic, in a sense.
Well, I mean, it's not. What do you mean? It's plastic.
It's not organic. It's not natural.
It's definitely not. It's not natural. We are synthesizing, for example, the messenger RNA, the segment of RNA. We can make RNA and DNA pieces in the laboratory, and have been able to have that capability for some time. It's then, in order to get it into your cells, they have to put a liposome, it has to be encapsulated in liposomes, for example, which just means it's got a oily, the messenger RNA is in an oily droplet that merges with your cell wall, so it looks like a cell wall, if you will, and it merges with your cell in order to get the messenger RNA into your cell. Folks, if there have been a lot of research, many, many reasons for, maybe we shouldn't jump on the bandwagon to take this, this gene therapy, if you will, in order to protect us against the coronavirus. And maybe we just should hold off until all of the experiments are done. And
maybe part of that is recognizing that the coronavirus is not that catastrophic a thing. In fact, milder than many other things that we receive inoculations against.
Yes, exactly. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is not the measles. This is not the mumps. This is not, mm-hmm. of course, rubella, which is the measles. I mean, so, and especially the younger you are, the less it affects you. I mean, so, mm-hmm. you know, most of the deaths have occurred in the elderly population who are susceptible anyway to, you know, to the flu, for example, to the ordinary flu. So to inoculate a young person, a young meaning, you know, even 50 below, you know, in age, doesn't really make much sense at all. But here we are. People are lining up in order to get the vaccine.
Well, they've been herded into a certain expectation, and that alone is disturbing. Listener poses a question for you, Don, and I'll just read it verbatim here. Hesitate to ask, but can Dr. Don speak to the reason why they chose the word luciferous as the patent name for the hydrogel component of these vaccines? Good point. Yeah.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah, it is a good point. I wasn't necessarily aware of that. But, yeah, most of these, the messenger, like I said, the messenger RNA has to be encapsulated in something that looks like your cell wall. Hmm. Now, it is a lipid, you know, cell walls are made up of a lipid bilayer. Well, this is a lipid monolayer, if you will, or it could be a bilayer in the form of the liposomes, which are kind of like little tiny balls of lipid with the DNA inside. But what they've done to the lipid is they've attached, for example, polyethylene glycol. And many people are have a immune response just to the polyethylene glycol tails on this liposome that they're injecting. So that is a synthetic polymeric molecule that is attached to the lipid.
Aha, plastic.
Normally, plastic. Yeah, basically plastic. which, you know, a hydrogel-like type of thing, but that's where the synthesis is all taken about, and some people are very immune sensitive to the polyethylene glycol tail that's on the fatty portion of the liposome, for example.
That's kind of like David's wife says, where what we are is the control group for a massive study here. and the truth of it is becoming slowly revealed. By the way, there's another link from the listener for about the luciferous. The Wikipedia folks have a page on it, so you can look it up. Come to brokenroadradio.com, click on that link, and it'll take you there right away. You can also click on Creation Moments and be taken to the creationmoments.com website, where you'll find a tremendous resource of scientific information that explains, supports, affirms the biblical story of creation. And we recommend it, creationmoments.com. Don Clark, thanks so much. We learned a lot, a couple of rabbit trails today, but hey, we learned something. And that's a good thing. We'll see you next.
Did.
See you next week, okay?
Okay, thank
Bye-bye.
You.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.